So I'm David Feldman, the director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Antisemitism. And I'm very glad to welcome you all to our first webinar of the term. We will have a second one on Tuesday, March the 22nd, when we will have Gavin Schaffer talking about Christian-Jewish relations in the 20th century. But today, I'm really, really pleased to be able to introduce our speaker, David Tollerton, from the University of Exeter, where he is Associate Professor in Jewish Studies and Holocaust Memory. David has written widely on theology, religion, and Holocaust memory. His most recent book is Holocaust Memory and Britain's Religious Secular Landscape, Politics, Sacrality, and Diversity. That came out in 2020. It's also worth mentioning that he does really stalwart work as Secretary of the British and Irish Association of Jewish Studies. But today he's going to speak on, he'll speak for about 25 or 30 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion. At that time, please do either raise your hand or put a question in the chat if you don't want to speak yourself. If you raise your hand, I'll call on you and ask you to unmute yourself. But before then, we all, I'm sure, look forward to hearing David speaking about the presence / absence of Israel as an object of focus in Britain's public Holocaust memory. David.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the welcome, and David, and thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. In different forums, there are sometimes varied implicit expectations about how finalized a piece of work is that you present. In this case, I'm going to present something that is very much a work in progress. Indeed, it's really an attempt to jumpstart my own thinking on something. So hopefully it's received with that in mind. So a lot of work that I've done in the last few years has been on Holocaust memory in 21st century Britain. And that's the backdrop of where this paper comes from. I've written rather less on issues of antisemitism directly, or indeed matters to do with the state of Israel. These are, of course, rather choppy waters to be suddenly wading into. But I think the argument that I'm going to put forward today is actually quite simple, and I dare say, perhaps even fairly obvious. But I'm not sure it's really been articulated, at least not as far as I've spotted in British Holocaust studies. So the origins of this paper lie in an event held in June 2020, when the Antisemitism Policy Trust broadcast a live web interview with Lord Eric Pickles, a figure who's very prominent in public Holocaust remembrance. By government appointment, Lord Pickles is the UK Special Envoy for Post-Holocaust Issues. He's also Honorary Vice President of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and he's co-chair of the UK Holocaust Memorial Foundation. Now, at the start of the interview, he was asked, "What motivated you to address antisemitism, and when did you have an interest in learning about the Holocaust?" It's the opening question to him. And the answer he gave was, at least for me, quite striking. So Eric Pickles briefly mentioned his work in anti-racism in the 1980s. And then he said this, and I quote, he said, "I first went to Israel in 1980, and it's been like a proper love affair. I love the country. I love the people. I love the 'we're going to get this sorted out' attitude. I love the innovation and the determination. I think you can judge a country, as indeed you can judge a person, by their friends, but you can also judge them by their enemies. and there are some pretty unpleasant people who don't like Israel. Through Conservative Friends of Israel, I started to go to various events. And then he talked about how he kind of became more involved in kind of public Holocaust remembrance initiatives. Now, the reason why I found his comments quite striking was that having just earlier that year published a book about public Holocaust remembrance, so the stuff that Eric Pickles is very involved with, I found his comments kind of sat actually a bit strangely alongside the extent to which Holocaust commemoration and education in the UK generally doesn't talk about the state of Israel at all. On the face of it, it felt, at least to me, like there was a kind of, on the surface, a bit of a disconnect there. In terms of thinking this through, in this presentation, I want to work through the implications of three statements, essentially three things that I will suggest are taking place. Each of them makes sense independently. And in fact, it makes some pragmatic sense not to mix them up together. But ultimately, I'm going to suggest they are interconnected. And if viewed as a whole, have notable implications for thinking about anti-Semitism and Holocaust memory in Britain. So I included these three points in the abstract for this paper, but just so you've got them to hand, I'm going to paste them into the chat now. Okay, bear with me a moment. Okay, so there's three statements that should appear in the chat there. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is just kind of run through these points and then make a few comments about the implications of thinking about them all at once. Okay, so the first of these statements, that Holocaust commemoration and education are frequently cited as tools for combating contemporary anti-Semitism. Now, I should be clear that combating anti-Semitism is not the only motivation behind public Holocaust remembrance in 21st century UK. More narrowly, initiatives are sometimes pitched as being simply about learning historical facts and remembering the lives that were lost. And then more broadly, the Holocaust is sometimes positioned as having much more universal lessons. Lessons about the warnings of racism, of discrimination, intolerance, and totalitarianism. But politicians in particular do frequently declare that that state support for Holocaust commemoration and education is premised on seeing it as a crucial tool for fighting anti-Semitism. In 2015, the Prime Minister's Holocaust Commission published Britain's Promise to Remember, a report that declares, I quote, "The failure to learn the lessons of the Holocaust is apparent in the rising tide of anti-Semitism once again sweeping across Europe. Remembering the Holocaust is not just a history lesson, it is one of the greatest antidotes we have to anti-Semitism." That's the end of that quotation. Now, one of the report's main impacts was to confirm plans to build a major new National Holocaust Memorial in central London. And in 2018, the mission statement of the new United Kingdom Holocaust Memorial Foundation gives a similar emphasis to the idea that public memorialization is, at least in part, about tackling anti-Semitism. The foundation aims, I quote, "to remember and to encourage reflection on the lessons of the past amongst all British citizens and visitors of all nationalities. And in dedicating itself to this mission, Britain reaffirms its commitment to standing up against anti-Semitism." And then it says, "also prejudice and hatred in all its forms." And you can find a similar emphasis upon the idea of confronting anti-Semitism in the work of the Holocaust Educational Trust and the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. Less than 2 weeks ago, speaking in the House of Commons on Holocaust Memorial Day, members of Parliament linked remembrance to anti-Semitism some 70 times amidst their speeches. And the Conservative MP, Andrew Percy, kind of concluded this saying, and I quote, saying, "We have this debate every year, and each time we can all trot out a whole range of different experiences and examples from the preceding year, as members have done today. But these statements prove the sad necessity for this debate and the ongoing work we have to do on anti-Semitism." So in that speech, you know, and in the whole debate that took place in the House of Commons, again and again and again, there's this reiteration that Holocaust education, Holocaust commemoration, one of the key aspects of it is about combating anti-Semitism. Now, none of that should be even remotely surprising. The Holocaust is history's greatest outpouring of anti-Semitic violence. So it makes obvious sense to say that remembering it helps combat anti-Semitism in itself, helps combat anti-Semitism today. In of itself, there's nothing especially remarkable in the sense or counterintuitive about that aspiration. Okay, now to the second of these three statements, the second statement that I put up in the chat on Zoom, that in contemporary Britain, issues surrounding anti-Semitism are often bound up with perceptions of Israel and more broadly on views of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Saying that this is the case should again be fairly uncontentious. Anti-Semitism obviously has historically deep and complex roots, but in 21st century UK, the most high profile topic around which debates on anti-Semitism frequently congregate concern the state of Israel. On one level, this relates to a simple pattern of how, according to data from the Community Security Trust and the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, there's a fairly kind of straightforward link between the number of recorded anti-Semitic incidents and periods of violence in the Middle East. But you can, of course, also point to debates around the very definition of anti-Semitism. When recent controversies surrounding the Labour Party and anti-Semitism were at their height in, I think, particularly 2018, they centered specifically around the party's relationship, or at least partly specifically around the party's relationship with the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism. Crucially, the party's unwillingness to adopt the IRA examples relating to discourse on the state of Israel became one of the main flashpoints. In academic contexts, and there are clearly others here who could speak to this more directly, in more informed ways, ongoing discussions about defining anti-Semitism via the IRA definition or the Jerusalem Declaration do at times seem to boil down to questions about what kind of discourse on Israel is or isn't permissible. So all in all, I think I'm on reasonably safe ground when making the statement that in 21st century Britain, issues surrounding anti-Semitism are frequently bound up with issues surrounding the state of Israel. So now to the third statement on that was in that block that I put up in the chat in Zoom. So the third statement that public Holocaust remembrance largely avoids addressing Israel and does not explicitly equip participants with the means to navigate discourses concerning Zionism or anti-Zionism. So my own sense is that across a range of particularly state-supported public Holocaust remembrance initiatives, there's often little to no discussion of the state of Israel. It is, put simply, something that mostly just doesn't come up. Holocaust Memorial Day events, for example, around the country are numerous and varied. But if you look to the central messaging that comes from the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust or the content of the main UK commemorative event that runs each year from London, sometimes televised on the BBC, you'll find no real engagement with anything directly to do with Israel or Palestine. Compare it, for example, to the National Holocaust Memorial Day ceremony each year in Canada. I use the example of Canada just because I'm a joint Canadian citizen and I just have some familiarity with it. At the Canadian National Holocaust Memorial Day event, it's always the case that the Prime Minister or other political leaders pledge their support for the security of the State of Israel. In Britain, royals, prime ministers and other ministers have frequently spoken at National Holocaust Memorial Day ceremonies, but they just don't make any comments about the Middle East. I think it would significantly raise eyebrows if they did. In public documents related to the new Holocaust Memorial next to the Houses of Parliament, you also find negligible reference to Israel. David Cameron's original vision for the new National Memorial was first aired in a 2013 speech at the Holocaust Educational Trust, in which he said, I quote, he said, "Let me assure you that the safety of Israel will always be a fundamental concern for me." And according to his 2019 memoir, he was particularly driven to create the memorial after visiting Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. However, while there were some links with Israel in Cameron's, I'm going to say, sketchy early comments about the project, since then, any such links have pretty much completely dropped off the radar. There are controversies around the memorial project, as many of you probably know. And these controversies have centered on its location next to Parliament or whether its claim to embody British values will potentially skew the narrative of the site. But there's no serious claims that I'm aware of that the site will feed into public narratives around Israel. Another state-supported Holocaust remembrance initiative that could feature discourses on Israel, but in reality doesn't, is the Holocaust Educational Trust's flagship program, Lessons from Auschwitz. In its very earliest form, Lessons from Auschwitz was inspired by March of the Living. And if you've got familiarity with March of the Living, you'll know that it, for the most part, it definitely does have a Zionist narrative as young Jewish people visit Poland and then Israel, kind of traveling sort of symbolically from destruction to renewal. The Lessons from Auschwitz program, now targeted at potentially all British school students and supported by the UK government, just goes from Britain, just takes students from Britain to Poland and then back to Britain again. And anyone who can spot discourse about the present state of Israel is just seeing something that wasn't very clear to me when I participated in Lessons from Auschwitz a couple of years ago. And it should be said that when thinking about Holocaust Memorial Day or plans for the new memorial in London or Lessons from Auschwitz trips, there are good pragmatic reasons why no one wants to make a fuss about Israel. To understand the Holocaust as a historical event, there's no inherent need to talk about the Middle East, at least not centrally. And I don't think you have to be too imaginative to think that for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, for the UK Holocaust Memorial Foundation, and for the Holocaust Educational Trust, overtly bringing the Middle East into the picture of British Holocaust education and commemoration might just create headaches. Given how fraught debates on Israel-Palestine conflict are, it makes pragmatic sense just to avoid them and position remembrance as inclusive and non-political as possible. One side effect of that is that academic scholarship on Holocaust remembrance in Britain has in turn generally said very little about Israel, about the Middle East. If you look to Andy Pierce's 2014 book, Holocaust Consciousness in Contemporary Britain, or the Palgrave Handbook of Britain and the Holocaust, which was published just last year, you'll find that there's just not much there related to Israel or Israel-Palestine or Middle East. Larissa Alwork and Sarah Kajun have, in their work, have raised questions about the extent to which Holocaust education does effectively combat anti-Semitism. But for the most part, issues of Middle East are just not talked about by any scholars of contemporary Holocaust memory in Britain, at least not in a very, very substantial way. But I want to suggest that there is a useful discussion to be had when you put together the three statements that I've talked about. So just to repeat, so these three statements are that first, Holocaust commemoration and education are frequently cited as tools for combating contemporary anti-Semitism. Second, that in contemporary Britain, issues surrounding anti-Semitism are often bound up with perceptions of Israel and more broadly views on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And third, that public Holocaust remembrance largely avoids addressing Israel and does not explicitly equip participants with the means to navigate discourses concerning anti-Zionism or Zionism. When you put these statements together, statements that I think individually are fairly easy to substantiate and not even particularly controversial, perhaps, there are some noteworthy implications for the situation of Holocaust commemoration and education in 21st century Britain. The question, and I'm being kind of deliberately provocative towards the end of this, the question, in short, is whether Holocaust remembrance finds itself positioned as a, or perhaps the, most prominent and high-profile pathway for tackling anti-Semitism, but one that, in a sense, kind of circumvents the issue that most frequently appears at the center of debates around anti-Semitism. To put it bluntly, even though a lot of issues surrounding anti-Semitism are bound up in discourse, perceptions, actions concerning Israel, is Holocaust commemoration and education used in a way of seeming to address anti-Semitism, but without the awkward business of trying to facilitate a better public discourse around Israel? Because lest we be in any doubt, that business is hard. I think numerous examples could be cited, but just I think a useful contrast is to think about school teaching on the Holocaust and on the one hand, and then teaching on Israel-Palestine conflict. So Holocaust education, as numerous commentators have observed, has steadily grown in prominence from the 1990s onwards, with the situation since 2013 being that, at least in the national curriculum, at key stage three, so that's for 11 to 14 year olds, the Holocaust is the one non-negotiable aspect of teaching modern history. The number of schools organizing Holocaust Memorial Day events has also grown hugely over the last decade. And you can assign that to various things, perhaps just sort of natural growth of Holocaust Memorial Day over time. Though Cara Critchell, academic at Chester University, has argued that it actually ties in with official requirements for schools to run events that demonstrate their commitment to fundamental British values. This is the more kind of critical reading of it, that schools are running Holocaust Memorial Day events so that they can sort of show to Ofsted that they're doing things to support fundamental British values. By way of contrast, consider the situation of teaching on the modern Middle East. EdExcel is the one exam board that runs a GCSE history option on the history of the modern Middle East, an option reportedly taken by less than 30 schools. Edexcel's attempts to create a textbook for that option have been mired in difficulty. In 2019, the textbook was withdrawn following accusations that it was too pro-Palestinian. Following reissue, it was then again withdrawn in 2021, following accusations that it was too pro-Israel. And then last week, Edexcel announced that they just wouldn't be producing a textbook and would instead be providing what they describe as digital learning resources. And we'll see how that works out. Holocaust education is, by contrast, just so much easier to facilitate and so much more prevalent in the lives of young people in contemporary Britain. Now, if you follow the drift of where I'm going, you won't be surprised when I say that ultimately, I'm not sure that this situation is very satisfactory. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that there should be less Holocaust education and commemoration. And what I'm definitely not saying, in case anyone joins the dots together in completely the wrong way, what I'm not saying is that Holocaust remembrance has a secretly pro-Israeli agenda. I just don't think that's the case and don't see the evidence for it. What I am saying is that we might have got into a situation in which Holocaust remembrance becomes positioned as the dominant way of performing opposition to antisemitism, but one the success of which is partly sustained by not getting tangled up in the main issue around which antisemitism debates congregate. The solution, I think, lies partly in being a bit clearer about what Holocaust education and commemoration can do and what it can't do. What it can do is generate awareness of a crucial trauma in modern European history. It can raise broader awareness around racism and genocide, and it can highlight one extreme outcome of historic antisemitism. But in terms of addressing antisemitism in the forms it is manifested in and debated in 21st century Britain, it shouldn't be assumed to be a kind of umbrella catch-all solution. In fact, perhaps we actually need to be cautious that it does not draw attention away from the hard and the awkward, contested public conversations about how British society finds better ways of expressing informed views about the Middle East. Okay, I'm going to end there. That's my foray into these choppy waters. Okay, I'll stop there and hand back to David.
Well, thank you very much, David, for a talk that was both limpid clear and extremely stimulating. I can see that Doug Rossenow has his hand up, and please, others, if you do have questions, please do raise your hand or put questions in the chat. I'll just get things going myself, though, by asking David a question, which is which takes what you said, but moves in a slightly different direction to the one in which you ended up, which is a question about why did we get here? Because although in a lot of some of your talk framed the problem you set out as a problem inherent to Holocaust memory in the context of the politics of the present day, others of your comments suggested this is a problem of British political culture or British memory culture. And I'm thinking in particular, you saying it looks rather different in Canada. So I'd just like to invite you to say a bit more about what you think are the causes of the reticence and the impasse which we've currently reached?
To use the Canadian example, one of the key explanations I'd suggest concerns how public Holocaust remembrance gained traction in the 1990s onwards. And you can contrast Britain and Canada quite neatly with this. In Britain, there was a lot of enthusiasm essentially coming from the top down, as it were, the kind of government. It predates it a little bit, but New Labour, particularly 1997 onwards, was very keen to kind of champion public Holocaust remembrance, frame it in ways that kind of spoke into language about multiculturalism. Holocaust Memorial Day is originally kind of put forward by Labour MP and kind of very much championed by Tony Blair. And then kind of funding goes into Imperial War Museum exhibition, and then Lessons from Auschwitz, and then eventually later this new memorial in London. And so it's quite, and the new memorial in London was very much David Cameron's vision, I think. So these initiatives have kind of come quite top down from government language. And for their concerns, they're not particularly interested in thinking about Holocaust remembrance in relation to any lessons one might want to draw in relation to the Middle East. I think for their concerns, it's a way of framing language about multiculturalism under Labour, or framing language about British values under Conservatives. There's a bit of blur between those two. In Canada, Holocaust Memorial Day was not a government initiative at all. It's organised by the Canadian Society for Yad Vashem. And they really petitioned, and with them and with selected parts of Canadian Jewish community, they really petitioned for it. And then the government kind of go along with it. And so it's organized by Canadian Society for Yad Vashem, but then Justin Trudeau turns up, does his speech, says many of the same things that are said in kind of Britain, but then also says very things about Israel. And my sense is that sort of public Holocaust remembrance, say, in Canada has had much more kind of overt agency from kind of within Jewish communities, driving it from sort of the 90s onwards. That's not to say that in Britain, Jewish communities are uninvolved in Holocaust remembrance. That would be, that's clearly untrue. But I think, a nice example is the Hyde Park Holocaust Memorial. That was organized by a board of deputies. It's kind of very much a kind of Jewish community organized memorial. And it's comparatively small, comparatively marginalized. The government wouldn't allow it to be in a more prominent place. That was in 1980s that was built. But then government enthusiasm in the 1990s and 2000s has kind of led to much more prominent Holocaust remembrance. So my sense is that kind of the reason why we've got to this situation is particularly that I would suggest that Britain's had quite a kind of a comparatively late and comparatively top-down emergence of a kind of public Holocaust remembrance culture. Oh, I don't think you're
Thank you, David. Thank you. Doug, you have a question or a comment?
Thank you, David. And David Tallotton, thank you for an excellent talk. I'll try to be brief. I'm talking to you from the United States. So, of course, I can't help but hear what you're saying as, at least to some limited extent, that you think it would be good if Holocaust education and remembrance in the UK does not go the way of the United States. You mentioned Canada, but not the United States, where the linkage between Holocaust education and the state of Israel is explicit and routine, if you think only of the most popular mechanisms of Holocaust education, such as the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., or Steven Spielberg's film Schindler's List, you know, which both conclude the narrative and the journey of the viewer or the participant, and both conclude with, you know, going to Israel imaginatively as the site of redemption after the Holocaust. And by the way, my German friends tell me that Spielberg's film has long been used in German classrooms as the main tool of Holocaust education. So I guess there's a transnational impact. I don't know if you want to reflect at all on that cross-national comparison, as you have with the comparison to Canada. It doesn't seem that surprising to me that this has shaped up differently in the UK and the United States regarding the presence or absence of Israel in this context, because I think the politics around Israel and Palestine are somewhat different in the two countries. And you can comment on that if you'd like, but I also, just bear with me briefly, would ask a methodological question, which you can comment on, but anybody else might as well, which is about the challenges of writing a history of silences, which in a sense is what you're, one of the things you're talking about. And, usually, I mean, historians write histories based on evidence. How do you write a history of something based on the absence of its presence? That's something that I've wrestled with myself in the past. And I don't know if you or anyone has any thoughts, methodological or theoretical, about how to do that. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. So there's a few things there. I should say, first of all, just on the point that you made right at the beginning about whether British Holocaust, public Holocaust memory in Britain should avoid bringing in kind of narratives related to Israel. I'm not quite sure that, I don't know if that's necessarily what I'm saying. I can see good pragmatic reasons why, if I was at HET or HMDT or UK Memorial Foundations, why I wouldn't. And my sense is that it's not going to happen. I don't think there's going to be more language around Israel in British Holocaust remembrance. If that did happen, well, no, I would just be surprised. I mean, that's in a sense, that's as far as I'm kind of going in terms of those statements. So I'm not necessarily kind of wanting to say that it should integrate language around Israel. What I think is more that I think the way we should be clearer about the way in which Holocaust remembrance has developed in the UK and then the limitations of that, for then assuming that it can then speak into kind of debates about anti-Semitism when those debates about anti-Semitism are frequently kind of surrounding issues around Israel. Now, the answer to that might just be that you say, look, we have a well-developed Holocaust education and commemoration thing over here, and then we just put more effort into teaching about and educating and creating public consciousness around anti-Semitism in other ways and put more effort into that. There's a few other things there. Oh, just a point, the point about Schindler's List. I mean, it's worth saying, actually, Schindler's List was hugely influential in the UK in the 1990s. It was distributed to every school, I think, by the Holocaust Educational Trust in the 1990s and was hugely, hugely successful. But it wasn't particularly translated into a narrative about Israel, I think, in public consciousness or any. And that's just not the direction of travel in which the way things have gone. And then on the point about methodologically about the study of absences, yes. I suppose in this particular instance, I'm talking about an absence in one particular national memory culture. And so at least I have the luxury of being able to compare memory cultures, you know, in a much, much more developed kind of paper if that was to happen. So I can compare memory cultures between, say, Britain or America or Britain and Canada, et cetera, et cetera. And then think about the kind of what I think is going on in some other national contexts and then not happening in the UK for various kind of historical and strategic reasons. That's not quite the same as a sort of broader point about the history of forgetting or the history of absences. I think they're perhaps slightly different things in that I'm interested in one particular national context. So that's a few broad thoughts on something. I think you asked about three different questions. But David, do you want to intervene?
Thank you, David. There are some questions accumulating in the chat and also in a complicated way by direct message. But Anemi has her hand up and I'll move to the chat.
So is that Naomi? Did you want to?
Would you like me to talk?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, David, for raising all of this. I think it's incredibly important. I am second generation with both parents being survivors. And I've become acutely aware that Holocaust commemoration in England seems to me to be disassociating itself from the concept of anti-Semitism, that the move is more towards the universal approach, what can be learned from the Holocaust as regards other genocides and commemorating other genocides. And I wonder if that is one of the reasons that Israel is not brought in as a subject and anti-Zionism isn't brought in as a subject, because I think there are fundamental problems in England around understanding anti-Semitism. And here I'm including not just what the word means, but also the history of it, its different manifestations over the centuries, and maybe its current manifestation at times in the form of anti-Zionism. And I just wonder if that's one of the problems. I mean, I've got a 28-year-old son who recently, in conversation with, I mean, he's an LSE graduate, old LSE friends, who have made comments to him that they don't realise are actually plainly anti-Semitic. So I'm concerned around the lack of understanding of anti-Semitism and how Holocaust education is not helping with that. That's what I'm putting out there.
No, thank you. And I think, I think I'd want to say that within the kind of the language, or you might call it sometimes the rhetoric, that surrounds public Holocaust remembrance, there are definitely claims that it is confronting anti-Semitism. Politicians say that all the time. Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, Holocaust Educational Trust weren't shy of wading into kind of controversies to do with the Labour Party a few years ago. How that quite translates into what's going on the ground in terms of Holocaust commemoration and education is another matter. I mean, Holocaust Educational Trust, in fairness, you know, do produce very kind of substantial teaching resources, say, on history of anti-Semitism. But I would agree that the kind of the event, we'll say Holocaust commemoration education as a whole in Britain can get quite complicated, in the sense that it's the word Holocaust is in the kind of the headline, but of course it's also about remembering and engaging with other events during 1930s, 1940s, and then other events subsequently. And so in some ways it's kind of about genocide more broadly. And then it's sometimes pitched in terms of very universal lessons about kind of democracy, about tolerance. And then sometimes it's pitched in terms of kind of lessons about anti-Semitism. And how those two, all those things work out in different contexts, works out in different ways. I mean, certainly you don't have to be too imaginative to kind of think that if you are a teacher in a kind of predominantly non-Jewish school context, you're probably going to end up emphasizing the kind of more universalist kind of lessons rather than the kind of the stuff about the history of anti-Semitism. I think it's also the case that it's quite, with Holocaust education commemoration, there's a risk as well. It's quite easy to just focus on 1930s and 40s and not really go back further into history and think about anti-Semitism more broadly. I do a very easy test with my undergraduates in terms of, you know, who did Holocaust education at school, and they all put their hands up. Who knows about the expulsion of Jews from England in medieval, early modern period? Maybe a quarter, far less than a quarter. And in British contexts, of course, it's, and this is, you know, this is being very critical, but it can be more comfortable to focus on the 30s and 40s because we're talking about a crime committed by people that Britain is fighting against. So this kind of makes Britain on the right side of history. Whereas the kind of messy history of anti-Semitism in Britain all the way through centuries and decades isn't as self-affirming as that. I think that's all I'll say. Thank you, though.
Thank you, David. There's a number of questions in the chat along similar lines. But there's one phrase by Anthony Bale, which asks, is the absence of mention of Israel in Holocaust Memorial related to a perception that public discourse prefers dead Jews to living ones?
There's kind of two levels of this. There's probably a perception that perhaps that British public are more comfortable talking about and thinking about the Holocaust than talking about current day Israel-Palestine stuff. I mean, I think that's comparatively clear and in some ways kind of sensible. You know, on one level, you would say if you don't want to have a contentious memorial event, don't mention Israel in it. In some ways, that almost sounds kind of pragmatic. But I think there's also perhaps, and this goes to kind of the work by Tony Kushner particularly, there's perhaps a sense that British public are kind of uncomfortable with more particular readings of the Holocaust, where you talk about it in terms of kind of Jewish identity, Jewish history, Jewish experience, and are more comfortable with kind of universal messages where you talk about it in terms of human rights or talk about it in genocide. Now, that's not to deny, it's valuable to talk about it in terms of genocide, in terms of human rights. But I think, I mean, Tony Kushner has written really very well about British discomfort with kind of narratives of the Holocaust that emphasize any kind of Jewish particularity.
Thank you. And I should correct myself. That last extremely pointed question came from Anthony Nichols and not from Anthony Bale. So my apologies to both Antonys. Louise London, you have a question.
Oh. Need your sound on.
Would you like to unmute, Louise?
Mute now, yes?
Yes.
So, responding to your recent remarks, David, I wondered whether I could raise the idea of two issues that that are difficult and don't get discussed much, but that could perhaps be part of a more successful discussion. And these are national identity and attitudes to immigration. both of which are very significant in Britain's response to the questions raised about anti-Semitism and the Holocaust at the time, and which continue to be very controversial and difficult to discuss. But I won't try and give examples, but except, you know, to just mention in passing the whole issue of the post-war immigration in the immediate from Europe in the immediate post-war period, where you get this combination of war criminals and European volunteer workers who are not war criminals, and, you know, mixed policies in relation to survivors. And I, particularly if attitudes to Jews are connected with notions of national identity that need unpicking. I can see it's difficult at the school level, but I think I made my point.
I'm going to lean on work of Tony Kushner again very briefly, but Tony's written very eloquently about how, in his view, Holocaust remembrance and commemoration has sometimes kind of fed into a narrative of kind of Britain as this kind of Britain as the extremely as this extremely welcoming country, as the country that has taken on refugees, and the emphasis upon kinder transport that has kind of emerged, particularly in kind of last 10, 15-ish years within the kind of slightly longer history of kind of rise of public Holocaust remembrance, particularly since the 1990s. And Tony Kushner has been very critical of this myth of Britain as the kind of always the kind of the welcoming country. I mean, both in historical terms, when you look at kind of the history of refugee policy in the 30s and 40s, or even further back, with regard to kind of to Jewish immigration, but also in terms of kind of links with refugee policy today. And indeed one of the real difficulties, I think, sometimes in public Holocaust remembrance is the kind of like what comparison, just on refugee policy, what comparisons with the present are allowed and what aren't. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in 2019 published a statement saying you're not allowed to make comparisons between contemporary refugee crisis in southern border of the United States and refugee crises in the 1930s. You just can't do that. And there was a major backlash against that from a lot of academics. In terms of nationalism, I mean, assuming that I've understood this correctly, I suppose teaching and commemoration related to the Holocaust could be a way of addressing issues about national identity in really complex, really interesting ways, particularly to do with kind of the history of Jewish identity and how Jewish identity has been perceived. I'm not sure that's really what's happened. And indeed, within the rhetoric, sometimes, I don't want to blanket this, but sometimes within political rhetoric around Holocaust remembrance, there's almost kind of the opposite of that, which is to kind of situate Jewish communities, or the Jewish community, or Jewish communities, plural, as the kind of the most British of British. David Cameron was very big on this, of saying, you know, Jewish communities are the kind of the most proudly British minority of all, you know. And you just had to line up speeches from the same few weeks to kind of realize that he would say very kind of the opposite about British Muslims. And there's something kind of potentially a bit uncomfortable, I'd say, about the kind of positioning of Jewish communities as this kind of the epitome of Britishness. Jewish communities are massively diverse, and I mean, it doesn't really bear that much kind of analysis it's rhetoric essentially. And so I think I'd agree that there could be a conversation about identities and about national identities in a way that there hasn't been. And British Holocaust remembrance in the last 10 years has become more and more and more associated with language around British values, Britishness. The new memorial was announced by government as a statement of British values. And numerous schools will cite their own Holocaust remembrance as evidence of their commitment to British values.
Yes, that's absolutely right, David. If I can offer an anecdote, that when I, along with Tony Kushner and someone else, went along and gave evidence to a David Cameron's commission, as we were, and we made the sort of carping academics, which carping academics are wont to make about, you know, what about Britain's refugee policies? What about how is this going to be received by other minorities who don't have their genocides and disasters memorialized? One member of the committee, as we left, his parting short shot was, "Don't you think this should be a moment of national celebration?" And to save his blushes, I'll keep his name to myself. Toby, did you have? Toby Simpson, did you have a question? You had your hand up a moment ago.
It mightn't be brilliant. For David, if my internet connection is good enough for me to pose it, I hope you...
Cutting in and out.
Thank you for your talk. I my question is about... if you could come back to me, perhaps, David, I'll open the door and hopefully the signal will get better.
That sounds like magical thinking to me, Toby, but maybe it will work. Are you there, Toby? No.
Well, we could
think. I think he's gone. He's back.
Shall I post in the chat?
I think have another go. We're close to when we have to cut off, so I think.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do my best. My question is about chronological framing, because when I learned about the Holocaust in school, it was quite implicitly clear to me that the chronological framing was about the Second World War, and it was in, you know, very much within the 20th century, with you know, in the context of, you know, a framing like the Age of Extremes, where, and that had significance for the kind of of material. So, from my go to, she was quite different with Van.
I think, Toby, we're going to have to leave it. I'm very sorry. We can't hear you, Toby.
I can have a go at answering the questions I think you might be asking.
Wonderful.
Well, you know, it depends how, where the question was going. But I mean, in terms of how the Holocaust is positioned chronologically, is it positioned in terms of totalitarianism, 20th century totalitarianism, and age of extremes, then it becomes sort of, well, it becomes a kind of lesson about history, and it becomes, I suppose, about kind of perpetrators, really, rather than the victims. And whilst when looking at perpetrators, you might be thinking about kind of anti-Semitism, you might just be thinking about potentially kind of the broader political processes by which extremism developed. I mean, one of the criticisms often leveled at Holocaust education and amongst scholars of Holocaust education is that there's often a focus on perpetrators to the neglect of the kind of the experiences and the kind of the lives of Jewish victims of the Holocaust. But it very much depends on how it's positioned by teachers. Holocaust Educational Trust are quite keen for it to be positioned in various different disciplines. If it's positioned in religious studies, then the narrative goes in very different directions. Holocaust in religious studies ends up being all about Jewish Holocaust theology, and I mean, I personally think it should also challenge issues about Christian history, but it doesn't generally in schools. But the narrative there, just the chronology changes. And then, but then a different kind of chronology you sometimes get, say, in some memorialization contexts, you would almost think that the Holocaust was just this kind of event outside of time in a kind of slightly kind of Elie Wiesel sort of sense, if you willing to follow my meaning there. Well, Elie Wiesel will talk about kind of the Holocaust as kind of being this kind of revelatory event that kind of burst into history and was utterly extreme and totally alien from the kind of normal processes of the rest of history. That's caricaturing him a bit. But in some kind of memorialization context, sometimes the Holocaust is positioned in that way. It's almost divorced from history and becomes simply this kind of iconically dark event of terribleness around which you then build various kind of values. So I think the chronology you put it into varies a great deal. Hardly anyone, I think, in public British Holocaust remembrance is putting it in a chronology of what Jacob Neusner in the United States would call the kind of narrative of destruction and redemption. You know, Holocaust is the destruction, State of Israel is the redemption. I don't think anyone in public life is doing that, because that's just not the frame in which the Holocaust has kind of traction in British public life. That probably wasn't quite the question he was asking, but it's the answer to the question I think I'd like him to have asked. Have we lost David?
Thank you, well, David. I think we're going to have to close there, because our closing time is upon us. But before we end, I would like to thank all of you who have come to this lunchtime webinar, especially thank those of you who have posed your extremely good and searching and pointed questions. Above all, though, I'd like to thank David for a paper which was both, as I said before, delivered with utter clarity, raising issues of great importance, and doing so in a very stimulating way. And beyond that, posing your own questions to yourself, which you then answered at the end, which is a terrific feat. So thank you very much indeed.
And thank you.
I hope to see you all next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.